I'm going to try to record cloud. Okay, we're recording just so everybody knows we're on, we're just keeping this for posterity. So, Julie, who's around the table here right now? And if there may be some other people dialing in, but do folks want to go around and introduce themselves?
Absolutely. So my name is Tabitha Carlson. I'm the project director with WorkSource North Valley with ResCare. Anything else I should include in there?
Don't think so.
Okay.
My name is Erin Young. Good morning. And I am the Vice President of Workforce Development for Southern Oregon Goodwill.
Is it just Julie on the phone?
Yeah.
Okay. Hi, Julie. It's Sherry Stratton.
But we're recording it, so you might as well let everybody
okay.
know.
Formality. Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
Sherry Stratton, Area Manager for the Oregon Employment Department.
And I'm Jim Fong with the Rogue Workforce Partnership. And Julie, why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself?
Sure. Julie Rossi, Director for Adult Basic Skills at Rogue Community College.
Awesome. Well, thanks everybody for being here. And we were just doing a little orientation, Julie, for your benefit. Erin is new to our region, not new to the Southern Oregon. She has been most of her time in Klamath Falls, and so she's new to the Medford area. So we were just kind of giving her an orientation a little bit to what this all is and who we are. I think the analogy is in Klamath, in the last couple of years or so, there's a new workforce board that's formed called the East Cascades Workforce Investment
Board.
Yep. Their office is in Bend, but they cover the whole Klamath River. Yeah, it's Liz, and then Liz just transitioned, actually, so their director is Heather Fitch.
Okay.
And what they're responsible for overseeing in Klamath Falls, there's also a WorkSource, probably Klamath Falls, a WorkSource Oregon Center. Mm-hmm. There's I don't know if there's one in Lake County, too.
Small
yes. office mm-hmm. there. So the WorkSource Oregon brand and system is the public workforce system in the state.
Well, I'm familiar with that.
You're familiar. So, yeah. So they're basically WorkSource Oregon, and I'm the equivalent of East Cascades Workforce.
Perfect. Thank you, Jim.
That helps explain it.
Yes, thank you.
So, and then Julie's with Rogue Community College.
Okay.
So just to give background on this and a little bit more, I guess the first thing I would say is what kind of questions do you all have? Let's kind of get those out on the table so we can make sure that in the time we have, we cover. Yeah, I'm assuming folks have read some, you know, read this document, because I know that given the, all the time and effort we put into writing it, that I'm sure you read every word with bated breath, like a novel you just couldn't put down. but let me get a sense of like what kind of questions you all might have so I can make sure that we kind of cover them.
So we have a list of questions.
Okay.
I'm not sure how we want to go about addressing those questions. Erin, if you want to
go
first.
Ahead.
Or, okay.
You might answer mine when you
take turns. Okay. Take turns. All right. So one of our questions is because we are looking at a consortium as a partnership with a few other folks is that we're already partners. So why do we need to be part of the one-stop operator role?
So what I would say is that the one-stop operator is a new requirement within the new federal law, WIOA, Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act. And my sensibility around why that was put in there as a requirement in the law was because they were trying to fix what were the complaints over the decade or more and more of the old federal law, WIA, the Workforce Innovation, whatever it was called, Workforce Investment Act. And one of the complaints about WIA was that it didn't do two things. It didn't there was no teeth to mandating partners participating. So that it was like if you're trying to create integration or because that was the whole point of both those laws was there had been so much fragmentation in federally funded workforce programs. They were all coming down through different silos, different funding streams, different departments of the federal government. It was also fragmented. There were multiple decades and multiple reports saying this is a very fragmented system and it needs to be better integrated. So the one big complaint about from the workforce board that people heard was, there's no teeth to this. There's no requirement that you be a partner. The other complaint that was out there that DOL saw as they saw it implemented across the country was that many previous service providers, old, what was back, the predecessor, JTPA organizations, Joint Training Partnership Act organizations, just simply took on the role of the workforce board. So there was no separation between the workforce board and the service provider. So for example, in our region, that was exactly what the job council did back in 1990 when we first got implemented. So what they did was we always said, no, we want to make sure that there is a separation between the board and a one-stop operator. The other big reason that I see, and I'm interpreting some here, I'm making my own, this is Jim's version of how I think WIOA did what it did in terms of creating a one-stop operator, was because I think in the eyes of the people who are crafting the bill, which all the workforce boards and all stakeholders had opportunity to kind of, you know, have input into the, you know, legislative process, but legislative process is sausage making. It's like you take all these different parts and let's put it together. I think there was a sense that of some the people who originally wrote the legislation was, in order to create integration to happen, let's say you have two or three or four or five or all the required partners, the you know, slightly under 10 required partners that putting on the law, who's going to put that all together? Who's going to make integration happen? So the sense of the law basically says we want to make sure that there's somebody who's got that role, who's taking that on, who's basically point of the spear and responsible for, and by the same time, as you go through the what's in the law or what's in the regulation, if you go to that section of this document and it talks about the, if you actually go to the reg section of this, which is on page two, or actually, I'm sorry, page three, number 678.620, I'm reading, what is the one-stop operator's role? That's literally exactly comes right from the regs and really the law. And says this is what the role of the one-stop operator is. And if you look at it, they're defining it pretty broadly. I mean, what they say is the minimum, the one-stop operator must coordinate the service delivery required one-stop operator. One-stop partners and service providers. That's what it's basically saying. So they're saying somebody needs to coordinate this. And they're saying that could either be a single entity. It could be a single entity that's already a service provider. It could be a single entity that's not a service provider. It could be a single entity, or it could be a consortium. But if it's a consortium, it has to be three of the required partners, three organizations, not three funding streams, is the way that we're getting interpreted to us by the state. So what we're doing here is needing to meet a federal compliance requirement. So the reason, if you know, and as a workforce board, we're open, what we put in the RFP is we're open to any and all options here. We're open to single entity options. We're open to consortium options. We're open to, you know, cost options, we're open to no cost options. We don't want to presume that there's one right way to do this. You know, and the conversations I've had with part of the reason, you know, we've done it that way is because we do think that in our region, there are very unique, very, very strong partnerships amongst all the different partners around the table. You know, when the state was going around with WIOA implementation and going around to different regions in the state to kind of get DHS, OED, Title I-B, you know, Voc Rehab, those key state agencies, they went on a roadshow, those statewide leaders, to promote partnership in the regions and to get local leadership teams to start forming that were more integrated. We already had that. But they didn't even come to visit our region because they said, you're already there. You guys are already there. Because we started integration in the state back in 2007 with the 1B service provider, Job Council back then, and the Workforce Board overseeing that, and OED. And what we said way back then was we want to leave space and have seats at the table when we're ready to kind of have that for having DHS and Voc Rehab and Title II and all the other partners. So our region has always been ahead of the curve that way. So part of that's a long, very long-winded answer, and I apologize. But I guess the bottom line of it is why we're open to the consortium model, whereas other regions haven't even considered it, and we're open to both cost and no cost, because we want to be very cost efficient. In this thing, we don't want to spend more money on things that we don't need to have. And we also recognize from our point of view, helping to convene the local leadership team, we see the local leadership team as partners around the table that are thinking they're already doing coordination. You know, so why do we need to pay some carve out extra money that none of us really have anyway and pay for that? You know, if that's a viable option, we can get to a consortium, we'd really consider that one. Because it's like, wow, it's cost effective and it's like honoring the partnerships are already there. And what we see with the local leadership team and goodwill has been, you know, come in just recently as occasional coming into the local leadership team. Title II started doing that as well. But you're doing things like having coordinating workforce academies, which, you know, doesn't specifically say that's what you should be doing under the law, but those are the kinds of things that our regional workforce board, we want to see local partners doing, is creating more of a seamlessness. The other point of view on this is that, and I've had this conversation with Matt in the past, or I've had it with Jim Farr from OED and other folks, is that I've been around a lot of service integration sites around the country. You know, I did consulting, you know, back on the East Coast, but it was national footprint. We were working with states all over the country. We actually commissioned a service integration study that was a nationwide study when I was working at Andy Casey Foundation. And we held policy panels with the National Governors Association about how do you do service integrated? How do you get partners to work together so that you reduce overlap, you create more effectiveness, and you create efficiencies and better results? And what I will tell you is that why I think the consortium model has potential, in particularly in this area versus other areas, is because I think it's really hard for one partner to tell other partners what to do. I don't think it works very well. Mm-hmm. I think you know, it's because everybody still has their own silo that they have to manage, that they have to have their lines of command and control, you know, around. And then you can have perhaps some kind of matrix management. But what are the key decisions that a one-stop operator needs to do? Well, my point of view on that is it's what local leadership teams are already kind of doing. So that's, hopefully that explains, answers your question. Tell me if it doesn't or does.
That does.
Okay.
I don't know if anybody else has questions. Sherry, follow up on that.
We can go round and round or whatever.
Yeah, I think a couple of the other questions piggyback on that. So I'll go ahead and ask number three on our list. Does participating as a one-stop operator, having a role in that if it's a consortium, does it create any conflict of interest if one of the other organizations goes through an RFP processes and has a contracting relationship with someone else in that group? So, and I know it refers to the firewall here, and I think it says the operator cannot develop, manage, or conduct the competition of a service provider in which it intends to compete. So for example, if say the consortium is ResCare, OED, DHS, and RCC. DHS has a contract with ResCare. Mm-hmm. They're going to, you know, have that relationship, or if they put a request for a proposal out for something else and RCC wants to apply, can't quite figure out how to manage that.
Yeah.
Because of conflict of interest that is created through that relationship.
Yeah, the way that I think that, it's a great question. I think primarily that clause is in the law because I think they're mostly thinking about the 1B provider. And historically, because many regions, the workforce board and the 1B service provider were one and the same, that was primarily the reason they want to make sure that there's that separation, because they don't want people who are the workforce board, who are supposed to be overseeing all the partners and overseeing and making sure there is a system and managing, you know, performance metrics and all that, basically, you know, then also applying, you know, to itself to basically be a service provider. Because in a lot of regions, that's still what's going on. That's one issue. The issue you're raising is a very legitimate question to me around the firewall, let's say between DHS and then ResCare in that situation. And the way you manage those kinds of situations to me is you have, you know, I'll put it this way. We have no intention of putting the role of the one-stop operator, defining the role of one-stop operator, other than coordinating services. Okay, we don't see it at all being in a role of procuring services, contracting for services. You know, so it's almost like you have to wear different hats. You have to turn the hat around or whatever because it's got different sides to it. If you're the one-stop operator, you're the one-stop operator as a partnership in a consortium model. The way I would envision it is that you're wearing the hat as the one-stop operator. That means you come to the table as local leadership team. You're coordinating things like workforce academy, cross-training. You're coordinating things like, you know, referral, cross-referral between different organizations, which is what local leadership team does, or like what we're doing in the adult basic skills, you know, group. Goodwill's been in that conversation. Julie's been in those conversations. Tabitha and her staff have been in that conversation. You're ironing out, how do we make sure that you're serving the common customer and that we're making sure that if there's property coming into Worksource Rogue Valley, it really could benefit from either going to Goodwill's, you know, adult GED program, RCCs, or vice versa, from RCC to Goodwill, RCC to the One Stop Center, that it's seamless, it's all working like a system. That's coordination. That's got nothing to do with procurement. That's got nothing to do with contract management. That's managing the day-to-day. How do we make sure that people are being served well in our various silos of services and making sure those silos be experienced as seamless, not as silos? You know, that's the work of a one-stop operator to me. That's all we're saying the one-stop operator role is. So I think the other way you manage that is that because so that if you're coming together as a one-stop operator, I don't see any occasion where you would be saying, we're going to now, as a one-stop operator, as a local leadership team, put out a contract for job services.
So in that case, mm-hmm. and this was a question that came up from Rosemary.
Absolutely.
So if Rosemary, when she gets to the point of having to put out a request for proposal mm-hmm. and say RoseCare applies, mm-hmm. I guess the question, and there was a conversation like, maybe even getting some legal guidance.
Oh, absolutely. Area. Oh, yeah, totally.
Some legal guidance to where are they going to be seen as having a conflict of interest that is going to preclude
no,
them from?
I don't think so. I think the way I would answer that question is, you know, we have a legal counsel on retainer. His name's John Chamberlain. Mm-hmm. John Chamberlain is a national expert in, you know, Department of Labor, WEA. He was a longtime WEA implementer across the country, and a lot, he's done the same thing with WEOA. We would bring, and the RFP that we did with DHS last time was a joint RFP that we did with John's help, you know, as well as the state and the Department of, you know, Justice, the Attorney General's office weighed in on that because they review all those things with the DHS as well. Mm-hmm. We would go through the same process. And I think that, I think there's very easy ways to manage the any either conflict of interest or appearance of conflict of interest issues to manage all the requirements from the federal government.
And I think that was one of the concerns too, was
absolutely.
The appearance of it being like a not a good old boys,
yeah.
like at this
right.
point a good old girls.
Well, and the thing where, you know, again, the one-stop operator is a mandated federal requirement, and you're not wearing that hat as the one-stop. You're not doing procurement as the one-stop operator. You go back to your silo in that moment. And your silo is, I'm DHS in a joint procurement process with, you know, assuming we, you know, either if DHS goes off on its own procurement or if we maintain our joint procurement process, which I would advocate for, then we, DHS and RWP are putting out a joint RFP like we did last time in that situation. And we're wearing those hats as the RWP and as the DHS. And if ResCare or Goodwill or OED or anybody wants to basically procure for those services, they can put in an RFP for those services. That's what we want. You want that to happen. And there's no conflict of interest in that situation because you're not wearing that one-stop operator hat. You're wearing your own organizational hat of, you still have to be able to do that. That's how you manage firewalls and kind of conflict of interest issues. It's the same thing in if it was a board situation. It was either board of directors or a workforce board. If somebody was thinking, you know, so for example, you're on the workforce board. Matt Balcoa is on the workforce board. Kathy Kemper-Pell is on the workforce board, the president of RCC. The workforce board is, you know, going to be putting out at some point in time another RFP, hopefully with DHS, for joint jobs and, you know, OMB services. As soon as we start doing that or any action we take on that, if you or Kathy or RCC or Goodwill said, we want to become a service provider, you would recuse yourself. You simply say, I'm stepping away from this table. I'm not, yes, I'm still a member of the board. I have a potential or a conflict of interest because my organization is actually wanting to be in, you know, service providing, you know, RFP response mode. You step away, you don't take any action on that. That's how you manage conflict of interest and firewalls. Does that make sense?
It does. I'm just thinking maybe from Rosemary's perspective, because I know that was her question.
Sure.
I think it would be helpful to have John Chamberlain back that up.
Sure.
And then I had also asked Matt about other places where there had been consortiums, and there's not a lot of consortiums. So he was actually going to ask Michael.
Washington Cross.
Yeah.
Okay.
Consortiums are very rare right now. That's partly what, you know, and I don't know if you all saw the email that I responded and I posted on the web in response to Matt Buckwell's email mm-hmm. to me. He sent it in. It's on our website.
Okay.
Under the... up here so you can see it.
I don't think in Washington they have DHS at the table, who would be like a contractor with the service provider in the consortium.
So under our website, under the, if you click on the main page, there's a link to this one-stop operator,
okay.
RFP, and we posted the inquiries and responses. This
perfect.
I got right after we sent out the RFP from Matt, and Matt basically, it wasn't so much questions. He was basically saying Voc Rehab, he was communicating that Voc Rehab wasn't going to be interested in doing consortium. So he cited all the reasons to it. And I responded back just because I treated it as an inquiry, basically, to make sure everybody saw it. But, you know, it's worth reading that because, you know, I understand Voc Rehab's position in that situation. I disrespect it wholly. It's their decision. But I also wanted to kind of like share alternative perspectives of how I think this kind of can work in the scheme of consortium. And one of the things I shared in that document was that, yes, consortiums, part of one of their concerns was there's no precedence for partners being in a consortium like this. It would potentially put us in adverse to our role and our mission. I'm saying, yeah, there's no precedent because this is a new law one. It's a new opportunity to be in a consortium. And third, frankly, to me, we have very unique partnerships in this region. I mean, when I was doing national studies on service integration sites, there was literally a handful in the country, less than two dozen. And of those two dozen, you know, there were maybe six doing good, robust partnerships. And this was one of those regions.
Uh-huh.
So to me, it's kind of like, you know, partly what I'm saying in that situation is, you know, there isn't any precedence for this because most people aren't as involved. When Melissa Wolf and you and I and some of the workforce board members went back to Washington, D.C. for that, you know, workforce board conference a few years ago, mm-hmm. I think our big takeaway, both you all came back with it, you and Melissa, as well as Nikki Jones, who's been on our workforce board. She's the president of CEO for Express Professionals staffing agency. Everybody came back and said, you know, what we saw was we're further ahead on this than anybody else in the country. That's kind of the good news and the bad news. You know, the good news is we're further ahead. The bad news is there's nobody else to look to kind of figure out how to do this stuff well. And it's the same feedback we got from the state. We're so far ahead in this state in terms of our partnerships. So that's, to me, my answer to the precedence question. It's kind of like, yeah, we're setting precedence. And part of my sensibility on this is I can show you links to multiple studies, multiple, Eugene Bardock, who used to be at University of California, Berkeley, came and did a study here years ago when we first did the jobs program as a partnership. He wrote that up as a national best practice. He never saw anybody partner like that before. Subsequently, you know, this Rockefeller Institute of Government study that we commissioned when I was at the Casey Foundation listed this region as one of the top regions that was doing integrated partnerships in human services and, you know, the part that was doing jobs and workforce, because nobody else is, part of its geography, part of it is the kind of quality of the people live in and move here and work here, but we have unique partnerships. Like, why would we not want to take advantage of that in my mind, you know? In fact, to me, I think, you know, I love that Aaron's here at the table. And again, I'm not expressing bias, because if other people put in four, yeah, profit and single entity, I'm saying even you as partner in these agencies, if you want to put in a single entity proposal, I'm fine. We want to take all the opportunities. Goodwill wants to put in a proposal, great. Four cost, no cost, we're open to it all. But we also want to be clear, we're open to a consortium model where the consortium could be everybody. I mean, I think on an ongoing basis, and you know, this is more into the operational, how we manage the partnership, I think we started having, you know, Title II and the Title II conversation, bringing them into the local leadership team conversation. I mean, great to have Goodwill part of that consortium, even though they're not, in the legal sense, it has to be one of the required partners.
Right, right.
But I think we could kind of say, hey, leader, you know, local leadership, like, you know, it's all about just, I'm interested in functionality as well as lining that up with compliance.
So, and Jim, I think that question, as Tabitha was saying, if there's a way to kind of summarize a response and get Chamberlain or someone to say yes, I think that was the biggest issue based on,
sure,
our conversation of,
sure,
is this going to create any,
absolutely,
future conflict that would prevent us from doing what we do for contracting,
yeah,
our services?
I was originally just going to post, assuming this recording works the way I hope it does, I was really originally just going to post a recording on the, a link, mm-hmm, to the recording on the site. But I do think, so instead, because it'll take a while to kind of, you know, it'll take more than a couple of days to kind of answer every one of these questions.
Sure.
But I absolutely, I think I think answering the question and getting John to help weigh in terms of his answer to that, I think it'd be absolutely, we'll do that.
Okay.
So, Jim.
Yeah.
So in the RFP, then we could kind of outline some of these issues and how the consortium would deal with them, correct?
You can do it two ways, I would say, Julie, because I think the issues you're raising and the questions you're raising are really what I would call implementation issues.
Mm-hmm.
They're logistical issues. There's like, how would we do that and how would we do that? I think that you could talk about them in your proposal if you were doing a consortium proposal. You could also not speak to them, and then it becomes a next phase part of the conversation where, you know, depending on, because we're in a procurement mode. I mean, we want to look at all the options on the table. So some or all of you put in individual entity, you know, proposals, or other organizations that aren't on this call today put in proposals, and some of you come together and do a consortium proposal. We're going to look at all those together, and then we'll make a determination. But the process that happens after that is we make a selection process, and as you make that selection process, then you start negotiating, you know, either a contract if you're doing cost services, or in my mind, it's going to be some kind of agreement, you know, some kind of MOU if it's a no-cost situation. And those are the things you put into that kind of agreement level to me. So some of that could be done, you know, as a phase two or next phase part of it. It depends on how much you want to get into that, because I think what we tried to do is make the proposal submission as simple and as easy as possible for anybody. Because all we're interested in doing is just kind of, really what we're saying is, tell us your background and experience in coordinating. You know, tell it, you know, if you want to include your LinkedIn profiles or your resume or something, fine. Tell us who you are, what your organization's background is, what your experience is in coordinating workforce partners and systems, and tell us what your own organizational capacity and history is in that regard. And tell us about it. And, you know, we'll evaluate from there, and we'll make a determination of who we think might be the best provider. And then we will negotiate with the provider to figure out how the heck we're really going to do this stuff. And when we did the WIOA contract with ResCare, I mean, the advantage ResCare had, Matt, they'd done this before, but it was the same kind of thing. We kind of said, okay, they look like the best provider. Now we're going to roll up our sleeves and get into details. How is this really going to work? And what's this contract going to really look like? And you kind of get into the down and dirty, you know, at that phase mostly.
Okay. Thank you.
So kind of connected to this, there was some conversation about clarifying who, if there was a consortium, who would they report to? Just understanding the roles, some confusion around whoever sees a one-stop provider. Is it RWP? Is it corporate board of directors? Is it the workforce board? What's that hierarchy look like?
Well, so I would say it's, how do I describe it? It makes me want to go grab the picture of the org chart for the RWP to help explain it. I think, hold on real quick. Visual aid might come handy. This one, I think Danny's got it.
Visual aid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess Rosemary said that she thought she could make it, but she couldn't. Yeah. Oh, yeah, you were on that.
So I'm so glad that Tammy has this right to the corner request. And Julie, I think you might have seen this, but we'll post it as well on as part of the answer to this. So why I pass this out, because I do think picture helps just answer the question, Sherry.
Mm-hmm.
The short answer to your question is the Rogue Workforce Partnership.
Okay.
Right. But if you look at this box, the subsets that you describe, you just said RWP, which really I think implicitly you were describing RWP staff, or the corporate directors, which is the kind of executive committee or the corporate entity that the subgroup, the executive committee of the full RWP, or the RWP is a full board. Well, they're all one and the same. They're all in the same box, or the same, in this case, hexagon, because this blue X hexagon really is, that really represents the Rogue Workforce Partnership. And that Rogue Workforce Partnership has a corporate directors group, which is part of it. It's not separate from the RWP. It is part of the RWP. It's the executive committee of the larger board. The larger board is the federally mandated, you know, representative board of 51% private sector businesses and 20% has to be from, you know, labor and or other nonprofit organizations that serve, you know, certain risk populations and or other mandated members like, you know, Title II and other folks like that. So the short answer to your question is, you know, the one-stop operator is procured by and is overseen by the workforce board, in this case, the Rogue Workforce Partnership.
I think where that question stemmed from partially, this is me paraphrasing what Rosemary mm-hmm. said, but so we have the LLT group, but RWP is a very active member of that group. So
right.
then how does the monitoring of the group happen when they're in the group?
So,
because it seems heavily influenced. I think those were the words that were used. It seems heavily influenced by.
Right. Yeah, it's a really good question, actually, because I do think that, you know, we are conveners of the local leadership team. I mean, that's part of our role. We pull them together and bring them together. And I think that what we'd be saying in that situation is instead of saying we're pulling that group together as a local, in addition to pulling that group together as a local leadership team, we are, you know, when we're sitting around the table with that group, we're sitting around the table with them as a one-stop operator entity. Mm-hmm. So, I put the example this way. I think at the last local leadership team meeting, the RWP staff were there, and then they were asked to say, they said, hey, we can't have a conversation with you right now because we have this RFP live and we can't ask you and talk to you about that unless it's in a bidders conference or some of the situation. Can you all please leave, and us as the remaining local leadership team members, we want to talk amongst ourselves, potentially to be a consortium. That's an example to me of how you manage that boundary.
Okay.
Because, you know, I think I appreciate the question because it's like, well, what's the clarity of this then?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
what's the local leadership team's role and how did that come about?
It came about before the WIOA legislation.
Okay.
It came about before there was a call for there to be one stop operator. It actually originally came about in 2007 or so when we first, as the workforce boards and the 1B and OED, mm-hmm. Wagner Pizer and all their programs partners came together and said, we need to make sure leadership teams are meeting together to coordinate service,
okay.
Trying to do integration.
Coordinate services.
Exactly.
Checks and
jobs. And so, and then what happened, you know, during that time, there's actually a picture I have. It's another picture I could show you that we used previously. There's also, we added DHS and Voc Rehab. And now more recently kind of Title II and, you know, Goodwill on an intermittent basis because because as we've grown in our coordination work, we've needed to kind of do more. Hey, let's make sure that this piece is coordinated with partners. So mm-hmm. It's been functional. It's been functionally driven by who's coming together and who do we have bandwidth, time in it. For a long time, for the first 5 to 7 years, all we could do is try and manage the coordination and integration of two large entities, employment department and the 1B provider. That was a big deal. We said, we don't have any bandwidth for anything else. When we finally kind of got that together and we created operational standards across the state, then we said, hey, we were one of the first to lead this charge. We said, hey, let's make sure we have DHS at the table. Let's make sure we have Voc Rehab at the table. And then the next round was, hey, let's make sure we have Title II coordinating with, because that's all about coordinating services.
Mm-hmm.
There's actually a larger group that we've convened historically. And again, we're further ahead on this than most other regions that we call the Workforce and Higher Education Systems Partners. And that included folks from Southern Oregon University. It included folks from the VA domiciliary, the Veterans Administration, it included Commissioner on the Blind. It included, back then it was, Experience Works, who managed the senior program. And those are now all, you know, either required or additional partners we can add to the partnership. So at some point we have to kind of just figure out what group needs to meet to coordinate what. And that's partly where all I'm looking at saying, do we need another entity defined and all that to muck that up?
Mm-hmm.
So
you're thinking the LLT group could be the consortium.
Right.
Some partners within it.
Right.
I do think at some point there was conversations about Greg attending.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I don't know that he liked meetings very much, is what I would say.
I think he attended one.
Yeah. So, okay. Yeah.
No, definitely. So, sounds like something we should be involved in.
Yeah.
I'd like to go back.
Did that answer the question?
I believe so.
Because I think it also goes into, Tabitha, looking at her questions, really digging into the roles. What is the oversight and authority of RWP and LLT? So just really, I think Rosemary was trying to get at what authority does RWP have over LLT?
Yes.
Well, I guess the way I would describe it, it's a great question, because I think, you know, you have to kind of be mindful about, you know, what does authority mean? And authority, in my mind, means, you know, who's authorizing, who oversees, who where is their line of accountability in a really more traditional kind of hierarchical setting? You know, and I do think that, you know, this is part of the kind of growing sensibility that I think partners have been kind of developing amongst themselves, including the workforce boards, that, you know, for a long time, the workforce board role under WEA, people didn't understand it. They didn't see necessarily value to it. Partners are saying, what is this? Why are you mucking around in our business, whether it's a college, community college, or employment department, or, you know, Goodwill? It's like, I don't get it, particularly when it was so commingled with the 1B provider. It's like, that's even more confusing. It's like, okay, so you provide services, but you're trying to tell us what to do,
yeah,
kind of stuff. And in fact, what the law's trying to say is somebody at a regional level made up of 51% business leaders and other executive level leaders from organizations needs to make sure that this thing is functioning as a system. Because the natural inclination of organizations in living in their own silos is to stay and living and functioning in their silos and to see the world as everything that matters in the world is in my silo. So go away, leave me alone. I don't need to partner with you. I don't need to manage through the gaps or the boundaries between my organization. I send people over to Goodwill. What's the problem? Goodwill sends them over to me. I send people over to Adult Basic School. What's the problem? And in fact, that perpetuates the problem, because the problem is everybody's in their silo. Everybody's got their own eligibility determination. There's some level of duplication of services. People are doing similar career servicing, and it's a waste of resource. And so the whole point of WEO is make sure that there's integration happening, because that's the role and the responsibility. This flyer actually helps describe that to me, because on the right-hand side under the law, it describes here are the 14 requirements of what a workforce board does. So that's its authority, okay? This is our job as a workforce board. This is what our staff and our board members, that's what we're responsible for doing, okay? And that's in statute, and that comes from the federal government, et cetera, et cetera. And included in that, that doesn't take anything away, and it doesn't take any authority away from any other entity who is either a partner or a member or a required partner or an additional partner that may or may not be named in the law. Goodwill isn't specifically named, but I think they're absolutely a key player that in the region that we say we need to have them be part of this whole extended partnership. But every entity, whether it's DHS, OED, you know, Goodwill, you know, they have their own corporate existential reality, whether they're a state agency, you know, or a corporation, and that entity has its own authorization. If DHS, it comes from the state, and the state gets funding and has mandates that come from the federal government, the OED, the same kind of thing. You have your own role, responsibilities, locus of control, authority. You need to manage your programs the way you need to manage your programs as you're required by law. What this is doing is creating a layer that's over and above, as I think somebody said earlier, umbrellaing all that to say, let's make sure we're doing this in a systems way. Let's make sure that's the, and we don't have any authority as a workforce board to tell somebody what to do. We cannot mandate to DHS or to OED what they can and cannot do. That's part of the problem in this, because it's all based on consensus. It's all about willingness to do partnership. This is the reason, actually, to me, this is not strong partnerships in the rest of the country, because it's the reason why we have partners here locally that are willing to actually partner. You know, that's very, very rare, because most people that would define partner is, I'll tell you what I'm going to do when I'm going to do it. That happens a lot. I mean, for years previous, when we first started integration with OED, their definition of partnership, their executive leadership's definition of partnership was, we'll tell you what we need you to do when we do it. And, you know, we're not going to tell you if we're going to make a policy change, we're going to make a programmatic change. We're not going to talk to you about it ahead of time. We're just going to implement it, and then we'll tell you about it. And we said, wait a minute, it took 7 years and change in leadership to change that behavior. We had no authority to change them. So to me, that's how I would describe the authority issues, is that this is about the coalition of the willing. And I do think this is why I think, you know, I don't know how replicable this is and other reasons where partners aren't willing, because all it takes is one partner to say, no, I'm not going to do that. And it could be at the state level, it could be at the regional level. And this is part of the dynamic with our, you know, the challenges with, you know, if a state agency chooses to say, I'm going to hold all this and I'm going to tell exactly what my people can do at the local level or can't do, that could stop all the partnership, or it could make all the partnership. Or if the state agency says, if Jim Farr were to say, I'm not going to make any decisions, I'm going to defer it all to my local manager. Well, you could end up having very much different policy and much different system alignments and or service provisions in each region. And how is that a statewide system? It's not. That becomes a frustration point. So, but the only recourse we have as a workforce board to kind of address those issues is to have conversations and to talk to people and to talk to people and to talk to people to say, how can we move forward on this? You know, so for example, I mean, I'll give you a very specific example, like with the RFP stuff. My advocacy to DHS as a workforce board is an equal, in that case, we were equal partners because we were doing joint procurement. You know, DHS did not have to do joint procurement. What I was advocating for is that not only do joint procurement, they do joint contracting. So instead of having multiple contracts, let's do one contract. They said, no, we don't want to do that. Mm-hmm. I said, well, here's all the reasons I could give you why I think that would be cost effective and efficient and streamlined and actually create better results. And they still said, no, we don't want to do that. And I still have a position of saying, I still think that's a smart way to go. But if they don't want to go there, I can't force them to do that.
Okay.
That answers the question?
Yeah, I think it does.
So is it the same thing with the one-stop operator? Like if, let's say we're a consortium.
Yeah.
And let's say there's four of us or whatnot. Mm-hmm. And we make a decision. I don't even know what it is. But we say we do or do not want to do that. And RWP kind of says, well, we actually think it's the opposite way.
Right.
Is it the same situation as what you just laid out?
I think so. The only difference there is that if we don't like what you're doing and we really get upset with it and we start saying, well, you guys are just totally going off the reservation, then as the RWP, we can say, okay, we're going to end this contract or this agreement because we don't think you're doing what we need you to do as a one-stop operator. We'll go a different way. We'll get somebody else in here to do the one-stop operator role.
Just like the other side where we're like, hey, this isn't what we signed on for and this doesn't work.
Mm-hmm. So the workforce partnership, which is the board, basically is the board. And so you take your decisions to the board and say, This is what we're thinking, and they give it the stamp of approval and then you move on. Is that what you're saying?
No, that's true too.
Okay.
But and I wasn't quite saying that. What I was saying was, see, in this case, there is a specific, see, this is the thing where to me, this one-stop operator is its own little bubble shell, or you think of it as like its own little eggshell or something that's being imposed upon the existing partnerships we have. And so it has its own little bubble of requirement or authority and that's something we do as a workforce board have direct control over. But our control over is either saying we like what's happening, but what that one-stop operator is, or we don't. And our control is we can designate you as the one-stop operator, or we can say we're going to do some other way to kind of be in compliance with this one-stop operator. But you're playing out kind of a worst-case scenario. I think I tend to focus on what's the likelihood and what's more the normal case or best-case scenario, because that's mostly what's going to happen. Mostly what's going to happen is if we're in disagreement, let's get specific.
I just wanted to throw out an extreme example.
Well, I know, but it wasn't specific, you know.
It was not.
Let's say Workforce Academy. Mm-hmm. We really think, you know, you all are running Workforce Academy. We're partnering with you to do that because on a functional level, it doesn't matter whether you're the eggshell, one-stop barber, or a local leadership team, or a workforce board. It's like we're all just working together trying to make good things happen. Mm-hmm. And we say, but we, you know, it could be our RWC staff person says, we really think that you're going in the wrong direction. You know, the rest of the group says, we want to have a workforce planning that looks like this. And the RVP person says, I think that's really stupid. That's just going to be a waste of time and energy. It doesn't make any sense at all because you're getting the wrong partners, or you're having the wrong time, or it's like you're picking blue, you know, tabletop, you know, tablecloths instead of red ones. I totally disagree with that. It's like, we either going to say, okay, we'll live with it because it's not worth fighting over. Or if it's such a big deal, we think it's really bad, we're saying, you know, I just can't live with this anymore. Those blue tablecloths are really just bugging the heck out of me. We're going to end the contract with one stop operator. We're going to go with this other group that's going to do blue tablecloths as one stop operator. Oh, okay. But then the local leadership team is to me, the odds of that happening are like so remote because we're going to say, okay, 99% of the time say, okay, I'm fine with the blue tablecloths. Or I'm fine, let's compromise, let's do purple. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, because we can work it out. I think one thing I said to Rosemary, I think, or Matt, as I was talking to him about this before we set out the RFP, I said, correct me if I'm wrong, but I hardly see any decisions that local leadership team is not a consensus.
Yeah, and I think it comes down to if there is a consortium and it happens to be the members of an LLT group, basically you still maintain those individual relationships, whether it's contracted relationships or, you know, decision-making, you know, processes. I think the bottom line is RWP cannot mandate anybody to do anything unless they have a contract relationship and that's part of the contract.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Exactly. How do we get, because I'm hearing the theme of this and you're really leaning towards the no cost consortium.
I'm not leaning any way or at all. I have to be very non-biased.
Okay.
I
know you have to, but I hear your message.
Well, I want to be really, really clear about it. It's
okay.
It's not that I'm leaning. I'm just, I see the benefits of that.
Right.
But I also see, the questions are around the consortium. If I was getting questions on the other side, talking about what are you really looking for if I was a single entity to do this, I would be having all those conversations and leaning that way.
Okay.
Describe. So if you wanted to have those conversations as a single entity, I'm more than happy to have those conversations.
Okay.
Yeah.
So if your feelings are representing the greater Rogue Workforce Partnership, you're speaking on behalf of, mm-hmm. of the board.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess my question would be, what does it take to become part of the consortium? If the greater group thinks that that's, if you know, we want to be players at the table.
I don't know the answer to that question. I mean, the consortium.
You join our LLC?
Yeah, you join that.
And that's the consortium, the LLC.
Well,
it's partners from the LLC.
But I only heard four, and so I was just wondering, how does that group?
So VR is actually part of LLC too, but they're not part of the consortium.
Okay, gotcha.
I feel like I'm missing
something. Maybe we could talk about this offline too.
Yeah.
But I'm just, you know, I see the writing on the wall. So I'm just thinking, you know, if we want to be partners, it's valuable to us. And I think we have a lot to offer. So, but we could talk about that offline.
Yeah. And I think Jim mentioned it earlier because, you know, this is what in the past, LLP originated just with the 1B provider and OED and wasn't really functional. But today, our local leadership team, 2 years into sort of the more integrated model mm-hmm. and kind of alignment, it's RESCARE for their WIOA contracts, and DHS is at the table. And I mean, they're one of their interests is the contract, the jobs program, and offset program. Matt from Voc Rehab is at the table. I'm at the table from the OED perspective. And Julie Rossi, sorry, Julie, if she's still there, from Rogue Community College. And usually one or two members from Rogue Workforce Partnership.
Okay.
Kind of that convening role.
Okay.
We've tried it both ways where we were kind of sharing the responsibility of bringing that group together.
Yeah.
And sometimes when you share, nothing.
No, you were doing it. Oh, I thought you were
yeah,
doing it.
Yeah. So recently, RWP is like, hey, we'll kind of hold this in the sense of scheduling meetings.
Oh, so they can be in the LLC.
Recently, they've taken on that role. I think that's something we can always visit at LLT because we're still kind of growing into. We go further. You know, we have like a full day meeting,
mm-hmm.
and so I think it's just we're still kind of forming and
figuring out who we are and what we do.
Yeah.
And just give guidance to the greater. We're really trying to work to integrate services to leverage what we have and provide better services to the customers.
Okay.
So there has been conversation about SOGI. There has been conversation about having somebody from the education realm come and join LLT. But we had always hesitated because we were still trying to get, I think what Jim was describing earlier was we were trying to get like the core people and figure out, okay, how do we make this go and get some organization behind it before, you know, because the more people you have, the more thoughts you have. Mm-hmm. And so you just want to make sure that you have some structure. And I would say that's kind of where we're at right now.
But there is a lot of discussion about, you know, the boots on the ground, the day-to-day stuff, whether or not we're talking about foundational skills workshops or, you know, how are we, our resource rooms or the messaging or registrations. You know, for example, over the last, I don't know, I'll say 4 or 5 years, we've made an effort through that communication to make sure jobs participants, and you're familiar with that, mm-hmm. are co-enrolled in all of the services, because in my opinion, jobs program, because of a separate contract, they always came through the side door because they went directly to that jobs contracted team. They didn't come through the front door. And so we weren't really leveraging those resources for those customers. So it's about looking at the system and alignment and what makes sense. And
I think what came out of that was that listening to all that in the LLT and having everybody there is that actually impacted our contract for this year. So now our actively engaged jobs participants, we have a goal of hitting 70% have a fully completed profile in wellness.
Yeah, and ultimately, and I think we're doing really good work.
Okay, interchangeably used. Sometimes I'm still not sure which is the right one.
You know, and it's interesting because you guys are doing some of the SNAP programs or will be used.
Yeah.
The other thing that we're looking at is educating each other about the different systems. For example, IMAT skills has been around for however long, but no one understood it unless you just worked with an OED. So it's just like, how can we align mm-hmm. the tools that we're using, this,
and it now will be
the talent pool, the talent pool to the business team. We have an integrated business team. So if there's, and there are conflicts that come up, you know, so we're trying to, a leadership message, being delivering a common message, making sure we're kind of all together in that message, mm-hmm. Sharing any training possible that's open, making sure everyone has access to it, mm-hmm. or at least that's the goal. And just aligning this because, you know, we all live in our own world too, mm-hmm. and we have that full-time job.
Yeah.
But it is really about...
We try to find ways for the customers too to not have to get multiple referrals, how to do warm handoffs. I think that's really at the core focus is how do we impact the customer through what they do and knowing what one another does. I think a good example is SOGI is an active member of the Title II group. And so now we've dug in more to understand what do we offer for educational resources for GEDs and things like that. So we created like a list of like, okay, if a customer comes in, we now have a kind of a map. We created a grid of understanding where would be the best plug for that customer to go, because we offer similar services, but sometimes there's an area to where it's more impactful for the customer to utilize one service compared to another, depending on
what's
their personal
title
situation.
What's called the Title II group?
It is, and Chris is an active member.
Oh, yeah, Chris goes.
Yeah.
Is that the Tuesday morning jobs up meeting?
No, it's a different meeting.
Okay.
Yep. Yeah, and I think we're meeting
Thursday, once a month.
So, you know, speaking
but
of...
But we got it together because we said DHS came for a while. I don't think they've come very much recently. But we said, who are the players who are either service providers or have a stakeholder or interest in adult basic skills? So
gotcha.
Obviously
okay.
RCC, their program, Goodwill was doing their program. ResCare had a GED capacity at the One Stop Center and the Workforce Board. And DHS was always interested because many of their clients need basic skills.
Yeah.
But so we've done some really good mapping of the system.
Okay.
And about what are your different capacities? What are your different cycles? Who are the different populations you serve? What are the kind of numbers you're serving? Where do
like
we get more integrated?
Meeting.
Yeah. So it's cool. How do you coordinate services? I took the time to draw a very complex picture, and I got to try and do a better version of it some other time. It's actually better way to describe it to me is before we get into this one, that think about the pictures I've always seen for network drawings. So networks are all about, if you see maps of networks, mm-hmm. it's all about some stuff like this. This actually is the same kind of thing, whether it's the World Wide Web or it's people and social environments. So just imagine, you know, this replicator all over the place. Networks are, here are your different hubs of people that know each other, connect with each other. And there could be ones out here that have, like, you know, literally dozens and dozens and dozens and hundreds of people on them as networks. And so you, how are these, to me, this is less about hierarchy and more about a network model of how we get work done.
Like Maryland jumping?
When you're here on that. Really, it's the same picture. I mean, there's a book written by a Science magazine editor all about 6 degrees of separation. This is the picture in the pic that they drew. And it basically said, yes, it's like neural nets. Okay. That's what this is, okay. The same. If you mapped out a picture of what computer networks look like in the World Wide Web, it looks the same as this. If you map out how pandemics become pandemics, it's because there's super connections happening mm-hmm. amongst networks. Typhoid and Mary, who, you know, gave typhoid to all the people in New York City back in the turn of the century, she crossed over many different classes of society working as a cook, you know, and she gave typhoid to all these different people. That became a pandemic. Same thing that happened. So they actually have this in science and math. She said, this is grounded. 6 degrees of separation is really grounded in science, actually. So imagine this a network picture, if you will, but part of what I want to kind of, to me, the mental map I'm starting to draw, that right now the blue, that's local leadership team right now.
Okay.
That's OED, that's ResCare, that's RCC, DHS, Voc Rehab, and RWP in that group, correct?
Okay.
Right? That's the group, right? Yeah. What we're talking about here is if either all that group or some of that group says we'll also be designated as the one-stop office.
Yeah.
And if it's a subset group, because right now Voc Rehab is saying we don't want to be part of it, mm-hmm. then they're a subset group. And it gets a little weird or wacky because it's like, well, where does their boundary begin and where's this boundary beginning at? And I would honestly say, I don't think there's a whole lot of difference because whether they're actually the one-stop operator in the modality or not, the fact of the matter is it all together and say that's the function you're looking for in terms of coordination. Whether they're officially designated the one-stop operator or not. Well, from our point of view as a workforce, how I see this working is we just want coordination to happen. We want good services to happen. I don't care what you call it. You want to call yourself the one-stop operator? Great. You want to call yourself local leadership team? Fine. You want to call yourself? Well, fine. We'll call you together. As long as you're coordinating services, that's right. All we really care about. So to me, I don't get fixated on roles, responsibility, taglines, name, who's in this, who's not. What we have to do is have to have a one-stop operator. We could impose. Goodwill could say, we'll be your one-stop operator, or OED could say, we'll be the one-stop operator, or Reds could say, we'll be the one, and you'll have one-for-one agenda. Trying to do the same exact and function of going, what functionally is different? Not a lot from my point of view, because it's still all based on consensus.
Mm-hmm.
One-stop, even if you designate one person to take on all that role, what does the work look like differently for them? If you took on that role as the one-stop operator, you're still going to meet with people, either one-on-one or in group settings, to coordinate and iron out services, like how do we make sure we have good referral processes? We make sure that everybody in the RCC, because one of their for success is not just post-secondary enrollment and completion, but also getting a job.
Mm-hmm.
How do we make sure that they get connected to the one-stop center services? So that's partly the way I think about different hats. And then the West is the larger group, which includes Easter Seals and Commission for the Blind and Housing Authority and if you're on one here, you're also on one here, you're also on one here, but that's one, that's still sharing. You know, Rosemary, that's still Rosemary on her staff. This is still, you know, it's like, oh, okay, how many hats, what hat are you wearing?
Mm-hmm.
So to me, if you're wearing the one-stop, and all we're saying is the one-stop operator, we're not going to impose anything more in terms of requirement on that agreement or that contract, on that entity or consortium, other than what's already going on in local leadership team, because that, and or potentially West. If everybody here wants to say, we'll be the one-stop operator, I said, fine. That being said, the only thing that's a little tricky about this is that in the law, what it says is the one-stop operator can be a consortium of the required partners.
It doesn't say the additional ones.
Oh, gotcha.
It says required partners.
Okay.
So that's the group that's in green on the RFP, not the additional.
I've read that, yes.
Right. So that, because I, and I originally I thought, I didn't realize until I, third time I read the regs.
That's right, so we wouldn't be.
Well, but so to me, technically speaking, I'd have to get guidance from the state to say, hey, we want to have a local, a one-stop operator that's more than that. Is that okay? And I'm personally fine with that, because if we, the more we can just make this coincidental, so there's not this inner bubble.
Right.
We can just say local leadership team, whoever wants to come and meet on a monthly basis to help coordinate an iron services.
Yeah.
We're just going to call them the one-stop operator / local leadership team, and we will convene it, and, you know, we will help facilitate it and take notes, but that group is the group that coordinates her.
Gotcha.
I'll push that forward if people are interested in doing that. And we may be, we say, well, maybe we just got to say, here's the one-stop operator officially, but it's coincidental with local leadership team. But some people on local leadership team technically aren't quote-unquote the one-stop operator.
Right.
Doesn't make any difference, because it's about functionality, not compliance.
Well, and how long have you been in the role?
Myself personally.
In your role?
In a sense,
but she was with Soji for 12 years.
Yeah, I know. It's just interesting because I just kind of get the feeling, I mean, I don't think we've had Shay back in the day.
Yeah.
But I don't think we've really had somebody at Soji who's really interested in getting invested at the level. So
well,
I think it'd be really, huh?
It makes sense to me. We're workforce providers.
Exactly.
Well,
well, Shay and I have these conversations at this level because we struggle for a long time. Shay will tell you, you know, we were convening this group, you know, since I've been back, you know, now it's over 10 years back in the Valley. And she was sitting in those meetings with Pete Carper from Wood Rehab, with Sherry and others, and we were saying, what are we trying to do here?
Yeah.
You know, and we never really got a whole lot done.
No, it makes sense that we're at the table for sure.
Well, and the other thing, because you're new to the Rogue Valley, but also you have the background, going back to the other conversation, because I think what I call true integration versus coalition.
Yes.
That is one of the differences in our area. We have really done a lot of, I mean, we're sharing so much, whether it's workshops, orientation, basic computer, or business, you know, so that's, I think that's one of the differences you'll see.
Okay.
Maybe.
No, I'm interested. Then,
more than you did in Klamath.
Yeah. No, thanks for giving me that extra background.
So I would love, actually, and again, no bias. I love a single sentence enter proposal. I love all the proposals come in. We'll just kind of figure out. I want choice.
Right.
So if Goodwill wants to do their own entity, if Redcare wants to do their own, if any other outside entity wants to do it, I'm really open to all. I would also love in a consortium model, if Goodwill is wanting to be part of that consortium, even though the law says it's got to be the required partners, I'm willing to push the envelope on that and say, hey, we want to make it, I mean, there's ways to nuance that.
Right.
There's ways to say the one-stop operator, it could be a subset, but in fact, it's going to be functioning as a local leadership team, and it also includes these other partners. And, you know, there's ways, I absolutely want to err on the side of partnership and inclusion, because that's just what makes sense.
Yes, it does.
The way that I was reading it is you had to have three partners in the consortium from the requirements, but you could have additional ones.
Oh, absolutely. It has a minimum of three
required
part, but what the law says, the actual law, I think it talks about here, let's see, who may be served under page 2. It talks about one-stop operator, maybe a single entity or a minimum of three partners defined at 678.400.
Mm-hmm.
If you actually go to the regs, which I did not put that in here, 678.400, it's basically what's under green, not what's under yellow.
Gotcha, yeah. Yeah. So you have to the requirement, but you can add on to it after that.
Well, yeah, yes, I think that's absolutely, I think that's absolutely
right. I think it is exclusive.
I don't think it's, no, I think Habis is actually right. That's the argument I would actually make to the state. I would say, because it's not saying it can't include additional.
But it just has to.
Exactly.
It has to, yeah.
It's a minimum requirement. I think that's exactly the way I would interpret it. So in fact, I think Tabitha just actually gave the technical assistance answer I'm looking for from the state.
Yeah.
Which is saying you can add more people if you want. You just have to have a minimum of these three who are required partners.
I'm around all day. So my question.
That was brilliant, Tabitha. Let's see if I get the same answer from the state.
Yeah, let's see that first.
So Jim, I want to just shoot one question since we're getting.
Absolutely.
I don't know how long this is.
We can go as long as you need to.
Okay. Well, I have something at 11.
That's
so fine. I want to make sure.
We said we'd go till what 10:30 or so, but
okay.
we can go longer.
Okay.
Yeah.
You know, as a single RFP submittal, how would us not being at the table currently knowing what's happened, how would we know what kind of improved results? How would we know what's happened to be able to answer that question?
Which question are you looking at here?
So A,
under
proposed board demonstration of effectiveness. Oh, A.
Sorry, just one. I know this like the back of my hand, but not that quickly.
So second bullet under A. What kinds of improved results and improvements in the operation of the one stop and the workforce system that you anticipate could be achieved? So not having the knowledge that these ladies do sitting at the board, how would we?
You just couldn't, you'd have to answer that just the best way you can.
Okay.
How do I describe it? I think some of what Kristen's done in part as far as being part of the Title II,
okay.
And what Julie has done in that are examples of improved improvements in the operation in relationship to the One Stop Center, because that's really happening between Goodwill and RCC's Title II and ResCare. It's not, you haven't been directly engaged in the One Stop Center services, but the One Stop Center to me is a system as well as a center. And I think that we're saying this is all part of the system. So those are examples of things that Goodwill has done.
Improvement.
Right. And the challenge is this is all work in progress. If I actually, it's a part of the reason we kind of put the question that way is what we're looking for, simply tell us about what you might have done that is actually you've seen improvements for customers in any of these partnership kind of settings in coordinating services. And knowing that we're still all works in progress, what do you think is possible based on your sense of experience and opportunity? And it's also, to me, it's the whole cycle of what resources or investments or dollars are spent that lead to activities that can get coordinated that lead to measurable results. So to me, those are the kinds of things. And again, honestly, all we're looking for there is what's your expertise? What's your capacity? Different entities are going to have different levels. And honestly, to me, that's why we're really happy to understand any consortium models, because I actually think there's strength in numbers.
Mm-hmm.
Then you're leveraging.
I would just like to add to that. I've been thinking kind of along those lines of what you just said, that, our partnership with the Goodwill has allowed RCC to improve our program, because we can focus on, what we do best and what we can offer students. And to me, that has been, a really valuable part of the LLT and the Title II subcommittee work. It just makes us all better at what we offer
right. For
our shared clients.
And ultimately, to me, that's really the kind of stories and or data and or kind of what I call methodologies or theory of change that we want to bring to our board as overseers. But I don't think of that in hierarchical sense, because I think our board of overseers, I don't think of it as like, here's this group that's overseeing and telling you, make sure you're doing a good job as a boss kind of hierarchy. I think of it as like the network picture. It's a group over there that's just giving us feedback. And yes, they have authority in a hierarchical sense, but we all, as people and as stakeholders and representatives of organization, are wanting the same thing. We want to see improvement.
Right.
We want to see value mm-hmm. add, and we want to see, we want to leverage each other's resources and capacities the heck out of each other. The fact that we're willing to do that, we're social species, So the more we can help each other by working together to create better outcomes for all the customers we're serving, that if we can document that and be able to show a line of sight, because here's how we're going to do that by working together, that's all we're looking for is an explanation or a sense of because that's the story we're going to tell to the board. And that's the story that they're buying and saying, yeah, that's what we want. That makes sense?
Mm-hmm.
Other thoughts, questions? It's been a great conversation, but probably because I'm doing most of the talking.
We did have a question, and we can save it for another time mm-hmm. if it's too long. But
I know it's fine.
What is the criteria that you will be using to evaluate the one-stop operator? Will it be RWP or the board?
Well, it's the same.
That's always confusing, because it's like, I always describe it that RWP is staff to the board, to the larger board of 51%. Yeah, I know this helps. This helps. This is beautiful. I haven't seen it.
You approved it. You were a board member.
I don't remember seeing it.
Okay, well, we handed it out at the meeting you weren't at. Okay. This is the backside of it.
Yeah.
You seen the backside?
Yeah, I did. I saw that.
There's so another way to try
I want the rainbow
right,
one.
The RWP is a guidance to the higher board. The higher board is the feds.
No. What I keep saying to Sherry is, and what she's saying is, when she says RWP, she's meaning our staff. She's meaning me or our staff, Aurora King or Danielle.
But you are the board.
That's what I keep saying.
Okay.
We are the staff of the board is to me, when you talk about the RWP, we have a corporate entity. We have a we exist as an organization, mm-hmm. both as a federally mandated workforce board. We exist as a not-for-profit corporation, of which our corporate directors oversee that portion of it, and we exist as staff who serve at the pleasure and the will of all those entities.
Yeah.
I serve at the pleasure of our chair and our corporate directors and our full workforce board. But corporate directors is who hires me. So there is, in my mind, there's no distinction between a board.
I need to change
and
my language a little bit.
Well, and you know.
I think it's confusing. It's hard to try. I mean, this is helpful.
It is.
But I still think there's some gray when we think about.
Well, because people assume like, oh, RWP, you guys are the board, and they don't recognize that there's a larger decision-making
who is
group.
Jackson County Board of Commissioners, Josephine County.
Well,
and
no, actually, they appoint these members, but they're actually not members of this workforce board.
Oh, so
they actually
corporate directors are the big board you're talking about, right?
No, she's talking about
there's another board.
She's talking about the big hexagon. The big hexagon has 26 members, 51% private sector members. The chair of that is Jessica Gomez. There's an exec committee or a corporate directors group that's a subset of that group.
And that's the group you're on.
That's the corporate director. They're all within this blue box.
He's on all three.
So I'll walk it through with you much more clearly.
No, that's okay.
The big blue box is the RWP represents visually the workforce board that's federally mandated.
Okay.
26 people. You know, Sherry's on that board. Matt Backwell's on that board. You know, Jessica Gomez is our chair, Mike Donnelly is our vice chair, 51% private sector members. We have members from the labor unions on that board. That's the federally mandated board.
Okay.
Within that board, there's a subcommittee.
And
it's an executive committee.
Okay.
We call it corporate directors because we didn't want to call it an executive committee. But it serves as the executive committee. And this is unusual because most boards in the world don't have a federal mandate. Don't exist because of a federal requirement.
Right.
Most boards exist because they're managing a nonprofit corporation.
Correct.
Goodwill's board of directors is
volunteer.
It's volunteer.
Yeah.
But they are a corporate. Your board of directors is your board of directors, and they oversee your organization.
And that's it. There's not an executive board of directors.
Exactly right. And but some nonprofit organizations, some profit organizations have both
executive and a board.
Exactly.
So.
And so we are the staff to the board. So when you say RWP, it's all of the above.
You're the staff to the executive board.
We're staff to the entire board.
So
everything that's in this box. So the staff are in this box, the exec committee is in this box or this hexagon, and the big board is in this hexagon. And within that,
you could create one of these with it. Is the big board going to review or the executive board?
Both.
So the entire board.
Yes, they will. They will. They have to authorize this procurement.
Okay.
Selection.
Did that help?
So most likely you'll be making recommendations, and they will approve that.
Yes.
But like reviewing the proposals, do you have a group?
That staff's been allocated to do that.
Okay.
Yeah.
And yeah, answers that.
And the criteria. When you ask about criteria,
mm-hmm.
It's basically on page 8. We're saying here are the points that we're allotting.
Okay.
Page
8.
So how well people answer those questions, assign point values to, you know, our sense of, you know, what that represents in terms of people.
Sure. Kind of like reviewing resumes.
It is, totally.
Yeah. What is your role as a staff?
I am the executive director.
Executive director of the board.
Yeah. Of the World Workforce Partnership.
Oh, okay. So you're the...
The umbrella.
You're the driver. But then you have a chair.
No, he's the...
Yes.
Okay, gotcha.
So it's just like Shay is your CEO,
right.
and you have a chair, board of your chair of your board of directors.
Yes. I'm sorry, Jim. I missed that when I came in. So
no problem.
Just now.
Oh, no, I didn't say it.
We needed a meeting to just explain this before we talked about this.
It all works.
And I'm so glad that I'm not the only one confused, and you've been doing it. You're on it, and you're confused.
And I've been around for a long time.
And so good. I don't feel so
and good. We actually had this conversation at the workforce board the last meeting. We had a couple of conversations with this because what I said to the board was exactly what I just said. This is very unusual because most boards don't have a federal mandate entity.
You need they just have a chart for your board.
And we didn't want to have a board of directors that was 26 people. That's just unwieldy. You know, so we said we want a corporate directors that can hold the 501c3 corporate requirements and serve as an executive committee, because most boards is 26 people. They're going to have an executive committee, and they can take action in between the regular meetings of the full board, and then bring it to the full board for affirmation.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So that's how we function, basically.
Perfect. Okay.
That makes sense.
Uh-huh. And I'll probably forget this afternoon to have to call you and have you explain to me again.
That's what we're here for.
So tell us that. I mean, there may be a couple little ones, but I don't.
Yeah. Can I get a copy of those two, the questions? Because it would help me to write them down.
Yes, I have them. Yeah. I'll send them to you.
I think one of the ones that we didn't go through are, and maybe they can kind of go together because we were thinking about them going together, is what are the reporting requirements for the one-stop operator? And then if there's, let me just take a step back. I think one of the conversations that we had is that we felt like as an LLT group, so we actually weren't doing as good of a job as we could possibly do because we feel like we could do better if we had additional resources is one of the conversations that we had. And so we talked about having somebody potentially hold some of the data pulling to help across systems. And so one of the people that we brought up was Greg, but it was just a suggestion. Mm-hmm. And so we talked about that as a conversation, which also led into, well, what are the reporting requirements?
Sure.
And I know it's been shared that we don't think there'll be any additional work, but mm-hmm. I think one of the sensibilities the group has is that may have been heard in the past and that hasn't always been reflected in reality. And even with things changing just in laws or
sure.
different processes. And so we just wanted to make sure that we were addressing the question.
Oh, I get it.
Reporting and then maybe additional resources were needed to make that movement go forward.
So I would answer that question in a couple of different ways.
It's a multi-layered question.
So. Oh, absolutely. and there's multiple ways you kind of approach the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
The first thing I would say is, how to describe it? I think that, my sense of the experience of most people I'm working with in these systems is everybody is working as hard as they can, as fast as they can, as hard as they can. And in most cases, in situations and kind of organizational capacities, which are never enough to get what done beyond what they feel like they need.
Mm-hmm.
That's just the nature. And I think that's true for the public sector. I think it's true for the nonprofit sector. I think it's true for the private sector. I think most everybody knows is kind of overstressed and overloaded and
understaffed.
That's the nature of the world as I see it these days. And it's certainly my experience. And so I honestly, to me, there's a reality base to all this that I see that I kind of tend to want to ground ourselves in and kind of remind ourselves that this is the world we're living in. That's one piece of it. I feel like as a workforce board, it's like I don't expect that we are, you know, going to go from where we are, our current reality, to the ideal vision any of us have, collective or individual, in terms of that ideal state to where we want to be, like overnight. I think it takes months and months, if not years and years, of hard, laborious work, taking 3 steps forward and 2.5 back, 3 steps forward, 1 back, 4 steps forward, 2 back. And that's the nature of the beast to me. My thing that I've done for the better part of my career that I've really enjoyed is systems reform, making public systems in particular work in a much more highly effective and efficient manner to produce the kind of results that public systems are intended to produce. And what I would tell you is that most systems reform efforts that I've been involved with take, on average, 5 to 7 years. And that's with exceptional leadership and exceptional kind of political and kind of economic alignment. And that if you're lucky, you can try and short circuit that. You might get to three to five, you know, but I've not seen that happen. That was our goal and why I went to work for Annie Casey Foundation. We thought we could short circuit that, kind of jumpstart that, get to that faster. I saw it happen a little bit, but you know, talking about shades of gray. What I would also say in that scheme of things is that, so it's a long way of kind of saying, I think everybody's doing as best as they can right now, ourselves included. I think our board, I think, you know, service providers, partners, everybody's working really hard. I think of this as a learning community, a dynamic action learning community. And learning to me is the best definition I ever heard was from Peter Senge. Described learning as the act of, it's just like walking. It's the act of catching yourself as you're falling down. You learn how to walk by saying, this isn't working for me. I'm going to try something a little bit different. You incrementally, you know, try and kind of do something a little bit better every day, every way. On performance requirement, I think what you're seeing in terms of the work we've brought to the workforce board is kind of slow moving dashboard effort that Aurora has been spearheading. And under QIOA common measures, what you're seeing in all that is, you know, those are basically rear view mirror lagging indicators that are at least, you know, a month, if not, you know, year or two or more behind. So you're looking in the rear view mirror into where you're going. And what we're trying to do with that dashboard is trying to get forward into leading indicators. I think that if I look at that and compare, we actually, as we were kind of preparing that, we're looking at what I thought was some best practices from the jobs program in terms of that dashboard. That dashboard was for program managers. It wasn't for overseers and stakeholders. So in terms of reporting requirements, my attitude on reporting requirements is we're going to keep plugging away at that as a partnership. And I don't see any additional, you know, I think that people already, we're already looking to fill in that data reporting process. I think the conversation we're poised to have with LLT is now you've seen that dashboard for 1B. What we want to do is create a similar, and this is, it's a very different dashboard. That dashboard looks a lot less popular. It has a lot less cells in it compared to jobs dashboard. The jobs dashboard is really, yes.
I like it. Tabitha's like, ugh.
Right. And I think what you want is both because it's program managers.
You've probably seen it.
Oh, yeah.
I like it now that it's broken down into more tabs.
Right.
When I get it, because it's so overwhelming when you look at it in one page. You're like, oh.
And so, see, my attitude on all that is, I don't think it's perfect, but I do think that tools are beautiful in the eyes of the users and the beholders. Right. And I think dashboards and data reporting are tools. They're ways to use measurement and metrics to kind of tell you what's going on, whether the car is driving down the road in the right direction through its compass and its speedometer and your roadmap. And it's like, okay, I'm going down I-5, or whether it's you take it to the mechanic and you hook it up to the diagnostics and they tell you what your RPM and what your dwell and what your, you know, electronic ignition thing doing, all that kind of stuff. You all are mechanics. We all are at the mechanic level. And I do think you have to have some metrics to help and or tools, diagnostic and or otherwise, to tell you what's going on in your system. I think everybody's got, ResCare has got its set of metrics and measurements for both, you know, measuring performance and contract performance. OEDs have their set of metrics. I think everybody's working as hard as they can with the metrics they have. Our long-term goal is to basically consolidate, streamline, and make those as efficient as possible as partners. So I don't see imposing additional requirements on one-stop operator, you know, per se, other than what we as a workforce board, we're saying to the partners anyway, saying, give us your data and let's work on a common dashboard. It's not anything over and above. You could not even have a one-stop operator or one-stop operator role, and we'd still be having that conversation with you all. So that's my answer on data reporting. I don't, you know, it doesn't mean we're not going to change our requests, or we're not going to say, I mean, I'm getting ready to put a temp spreadsheet in front of all the partners, state and local, and say, we'd like to know all your inputs. What are all the resources you have coming in to this region in terms of total dollar costs? We have them for 1B. We don't have them. We got them once years ago from the state for OED and for DHS and other partners. But to me, how you manage with metrics is you have to look at your inputs, you have to look at your outputs, your activities, and you have to look at your outcomes. That's how you, that's a logic model to me. And I think, you know, I wouldn't be imposing it on the, as a workforce board, we would not be imposing that on the one-stop operator because we don't think the, one-stop operator, you know, that seems something that we should hold as a workforce board with those partners directly, whether they're a one-stop operator or a partner. That doesn't matter whether you're a one-stop operator or not. If we're trying to manage the system, we have to look at the system data from all the partners. We'd ask that of Goodwill or VA, and to the degree that people can give it, great. If they can't, okay, we don't have a piece of that puzzle right now. We'll see if we can get it, you know, over time. So that's my answer at data reporting. I don't envision anything more additional to the one-stop operator than what, and I don't see the one putting that role on the one-stop operator, because I think that's our role as a workforce board to create those dashboards in partnership with you all. That's a task that we have in partnership. In terms of the additional resource, so what I would say about that is this is a zero-sum game, okay? The one-stop operator role and responsibility is a shared common cost. It's not something that 1B is going to bear on its own. It's not something that, you know, OED is going to bear on its own. This is something that goes into the cost pool. So to me, if we do get a proposal to come in, this is where it does get kind of, you know, I don't know how you call it. You get into all sorts of interesting conflict of interest issues with this one. But the way the cost sharing is penciling out is that all the required partners, folks on this page, you know, they're required to pay in for common costs based on proportional share and benefits received. And the methodology, this is the meeting we're going to have next week, you know, the methodology they're working off of right now using sample data from last fiscal year is a combination of, if you're in the one-stop center physically located, there's a square footage and FTE and an infrastructure cost associated with that would be part of cost sharing. If you're and if whether you're in the one-stop center or not, there's going to be a common cost pool for career services and for shared costs that, you know, and that's going to be based on a participant count. And part of that common cost pool is going to be all the career service staff that are providing career services, as well as their associated overhead costs, as well as if we get a proposal in that says, hey, whether it's a consortium or whether it's ResCare or OED or Goodwill or OMAP or somebody puts in a proposal, says, we propose $50,000 to spend $50,000 or $100,000 or $200,000 or $25,000 as a one-stop operator, and we would propose spending this kind of money. We would propose that, you know, we will hired some additional staff to do data gathering, even though we're not requiring it. Mm-hmm. You know, we're anticipating. We think it's just part of the normal partnership. It's not something we're putting on the one-stop operator. But if we got a proposal on that, what we would then have to do is determine whether or not we thought that was a viable proposal. And then we have to sit with all the partners that actually put money into the cost sharing. So that's Jim Farr at OED, that's, you know, Matt Bockwell, that's, you know, all these required partners. Because we have to agree to the common cost and we have to agree to the methodology. And we would basically put that staff person or that FTE percentage into that common cost pool. So we're basically taking money from ourselves to pay for that position. And you're not a decision maker in that as ResCare, because ResCare doesn't decide a 1B allocation dollars or the methodology. That's something we hold as a workforce board. Mm-hmm. That would come off the top of any contract we give you. That would come off the top of any OED dollars that they're providing to staff. So the partners would have to basically say, I want to pay for that kind of capacity and service.
So the areas that go with like an OMAP, uh-huh, all of them pay for the OMAP?
No, OED. No, it depends. Oh. It depends on the different regions could do this differently.
Oh, okay.
Because their methodology can vary by region. The cost allocation methodology, I can't speak to what the other regions are doing for cost allocation methodology.
Okay,
what they're
so
putting
this
in the common
is directed by the cost allocation methodology.
It is totally
okay.
By cost allocation. So if another region basically is doing the same as us, and some of them are, they're using participant counts, you know, in that situation. And yes, the partners who are required to pay into that are paying for the common cost.
Okay.
But I don't know that that's actually happening. I'm not that close to what the other regions.
Okay.
Does that answer that question?
Yeah, and then I had a question. Can I
jump in real quick?
Yeah.
I have to leave.
Absolutely.
I have to run. I really appreciate everybody's help. And
yeah, absolutely. It's great. It's great to have you at the table.
Thank you.
I love that. It's really wonderful.
But is next week's call, are they going to be the same, or are you going to be building on new information?
It depends on who shows up.
Okay.
We set it up to want to do more than not. We just figured we carve out space, because this is the only time, other than this and other than emails we get, we can't talk to partners.
Okay.
You know, so we want to make sure we err on the side of having
enough
sessions.
Okay. Could be the same.
Yeah, it depends on
nobody showing.
That's exactly right. Okay. If you all come and you want to continue this next round of conversation, that's absolutely fine. We're here to answer your questions.
Perfect.
So that whether
you don't say anything good while I'm gone.
Well, hopefully it'll all be recorded. You could just see it then.
That's true.
We should go
Thank
ahead.
You so much.
No problem.
I think there's only one kind of simple just clarifying, because you're getting the sheet with the questions, which was related to.
Great to meet you, Erin.
Thanks, John.
Yeah.
Great to have you here.
I'll see you at the leadership team on Sunday.
What's that?
Leadership meeting.
Oh, that, okay.
We'll get Tammy to add her to the.
Yeah, absolutely.
So there was a question about putting in it as a cost proposal if we wanted additional resources, like for somebody to support the role of holding some of the data, which seemed transparent, but there had been a question just because originally we had put in a proposal as ResCare as a single entity. But I think the confusion stemmed from it saying it was a no-cost proposal, but really having some associated.
Well, you're assigning costs. And you actually, what you were proposing in that proposal was to actually take it out all on 1B.
Okay, yeah,
you know,
okay.
So it wasn't a no-cost proposal, it was a cost-allocated proposal. You know, you were carving it out of a 1B contract that you actually didn't have authorization to do unless we approved it.
Yeah.
So
they weren't asking for additional money, they were.
They were signing staff, and FT and infrastructure and overhead costs and, you know, their indirect costs to a portion of an FT that they were allocating to be the one-stop operator.
Okay. So how would it look, say if we said, you know, we would like to ask for $15,000 to pay for a piece of an existing staff within one of the organizations to provide support to LLT.
Right.
How would you approach that? Just ask for the money?
Yeah, well, it's a great question. I hadn't thought about that scenario. You know, in some ways, it's the perfection of having the cost-sharing conversation simultaneous right now, because it gets a little weird because, you know, we're not supposed to be talking about one-stop operator procurement, but that's not procurement, that's one-stop operator funding. You know, what I would do is, my thinking right at the top, and I want to double check and talk to Sherry and John Chamberlain about this to make sure it's like, this is the right way to handle firewalls and all this stuff. The fact that you've brought this up in this conversation, and the fact that we have a one-stop operator, not a one-stop operator, a cost-sharing infrastructure agreement meeting next week as well, what I would tend to do is to, in those meetings, I would bring up to people, by the way, folks, you know, as we're trying to nail down what the agreed to a methodology and a potential cost that each of us would incur as partners in this, whether we're 1B or OED or Title II or anybody else, one of the things that is on the radar screen is that we have a potential consortium of partners, many of whom are you around this table, and it's one-stop operator modality, thinking about putting in a proposal that would include some monies, like say $15,000 to hire for a portion of a person's FT to pay for data reporting costs. I would say to those folks, either in those meetings or after we've made the selection, do you want to buy it, pay for that? Because, you know, we can't, again, I don't think that I can mandate as a workforce board what partners are willing to pay for.
Yeah.
You know, Jim and Julie's or Kathy Kemper-Pell and all the other required partners who have to sign off on the consortium agreement, particularly the ones that are putting the bulk of the bill, you're literally robbing Peter to pay Paul.
Yeah.
You know, you're reallocating resources. And the other thing I would say about that is, I think as a workforce board, we would consider that proposal, and then to make, you know, we would look at all the proposals that are on the table, whether they're for cost, not for cost, consortium, whatever. We would, well, once those proposals submitted, we would, my sense of it is what we would probably do is then narrow it down, either select one or two or three, whatever the top candidates, talk to them, negotiate, and then make a selection by the 25th. We're just giving ourselves 2 days to make a selection, basically. But then, you know, once we make a selection, then we're negotiating. And we could negotiate, basically, to say,
sure.
So you're thinking that there's a cost for data compilation, even though, you know, we're not putting any kind of data reporting requirements on you as a partnership, you know? And part of the question that I would kind of then negotiate around is saying, so this is a staff person you already have. What is it that they're going to do that's different what they're already doing, you know,
in terms of data gathering? Okay.
For what purpose and who's asking for that? Because we're not asking for it at this point in time. And so it becomes this whole cyclic kind of thing. It's like, I would negotiate. It's like, is there really a cost there? Because, or is it just something you wanted? We'd have to just talk about it to me.
Yeah, and just, because I think it was an exploratory question.
Sure.
And how we can strengthen the LLT group.
Sure.
In the sense of adding some support. I think
right. Yeah, no, I love the concept. I love the forward thinking of it. And I think there's multiple ways to kind of manage it because, you know, it doesn't have to be on the front end of an agreement or a contract.
Sure.
It could be something that, let's talk about this, you know, let's talk, but you'd have to have the conversation in both those places. Because on the one hand, you'd have to wear the hat as the one-stop operator and our partnership with the workforce boards. Like, we think we'd like to kind of create more staffing around local leadership team. Okay, great. That's a great concept. Then you got to go over there and sit with those same partners who are all required. Some of them are on local leadership team or maybe may not be part of the one-stop operator and say, hey, y'all, you know, we haven't made a determination. I mean, you know how I describe it. I bet you there are some workforce boards that are basically unilaterally deciding what's going to be in that cost pool and what's not. But at the same time, to me, all it takes is one partner. Let's say it's Jim Farr. He says, I don't want to pay for that. Mm-hmm. Then he's going to say, I'm not going to sign him off on this agreement if that's included in the cost. So you might as well go talk to him on the front end and say, here's what's in the cost pool. Any problems? Speak now before we start going into the methodology. And the question then is, well, if you and Jim are going to be paying your whatever percentage share of that additional $15,000 or $20,000 or $50,000 that you're not already paying for, are you all okay with that? And if you want to do that, then we all collectively, it's the same thing. I mean, right now, you know, we've ended the JD Energy. We've ended a bunch of other grants. You know, the budget cuts that are going into the contracts for the 1B are significant. You know? So to me, the question is, okay, is this where that negotiation I would want to have, whether it's as point of stop operator or as just as a local leadership team partner, it's like, okay, is that really where we need to put our resources?
Mm-hmm.
And if people could say convincingly, yeah, that seems like a good use of resources. Everybody agrees, instead of doing more OJTs or more whatever else, we want to put resources in that capacity. And my question again gets to be, what are you doing with the 15,000 if the person's already being paid? And what are they doing differently? What additional tasks are you putting on them?
In this scenario, it's not an within the existing, we were just exploring.
No, I get it. I love the forward thinking. I'm just, you have to then ground it. It's like, what's the work you really, see, that's the bottom line of all these conversations to me is, what's the real work? You can have shells of compliance and operator designations and all that kind of stuff. The bottom line to me is, how does the real work get done? How does partnership really happen? So that would be the conversation I want to have. It's like, I love the idea. I love the kind of concept. It's like, okay, think that through with me a little bit more. What exactly are you thinking is the data you want to run? And how is that specific to a one-stop operator versus something that we should be already doing as a partner, a partnership, you know? And if you're wanting specifically for LLT, what's the thinking behind it? What do you think will benefit or the capacity for LLT? And I get it. I mean, the more... It is the challenge is LLT is people coming together, they got all this other work to do, but Greg's already got a job. Why couldn't he already do what he's doing in that situation? Or what would you do with the extra 15,000? Is it hire somebody else behind him to do something that he's not
I
doing?
I think we would have to talk about it more because I don't think it was just right. Like.
No, it's an idea.
Yeah.
I get it. I totally get it.
And it was around the discussion of like, how do we, what is the role of LLT versus RWP and.
Right.
You know, how do we put more support around that?
How do we hold it better to do a better job?
Yeah.
And the issue was, we all have jobs, so we're trying to put, you know, this is part of it, but.
I don't think it's a.
Well, and this is partly where I go back, and this is the conversation I had with Matt. I said, the last thing I want to do is ask people to do more than they're already doing. Because I already feel like everybody's working hard. And you know what? LLT is already part of what people are already doing. And you know what? We're doing some good stuff there. And yes, there's absolutely more we could do. And you know what? It's all about resources.
Mm-hmm.
In the world of unlimited resources, it'd be great to have LLT have its own staff. I mean, what I would do in that situation, if we wanted to do that, I would hire an extra RWP. I mean, we could do this. I could literally take create another position in RWP to staff LLT.
Yeah.
And you know, what I would do is I'd be charging that cost to, in the cost allocation methodology, I haven't seen the percentages yet. The last percentage I saw, 1B was about, and OED were about 40% of each. The bulk of that money would, 80% of that money would come out of.
Yeah, we weren't thinking it would be a full-time person. We were thinking like, you know, 8 to 10 hours a month or something like that.
And again, I go back to do what and what's the value proposition.
Yeah.
Julie, are you still on the phone?
Yeah, I have two clarifying questions, and then I have to go.
Go for it.
We're done.
Yeah. Okay. Go ahead, Julie.
The cost that we have on Wednesday. Is that for the RFP or the MOU or both?
It's a great question. I frequently, even as I talk about this amongst ourselves, we always kind of get mixed up between the two. So here's how it kind of all works together. The MOU is this overarching document that's required under the law. You have to have an MOU. If you look at the law, it actually says part of that MOU is a cost sharing. They actually call it an infrastructure agreement. But it's confusing when they use that terminology because infrastructure included in their definition of infrastructure are career services and other shared costs. Mm-hmm. So I've started calling it cost sharing slash infrastructure sharing agreement because it seems like it's more describes to people what it is, you know, you're sharing costs basically of this common career services in a one-stop center. Mm-hmm. So what we're going to do is, I think I'm working on constructing so that I don't want to have to change the signatory process on the MOU every time we adjust or amend the infrastructure sharing agreement or every time we change anything underneath that MOU. So I think what we're going to do is have two tiers of signatures, one for the MOU so that it's like, yeah, we're all agreeing to partner. And then we're going to have this once this cost sharing sub-agreement that's part of the MOU because I think it needs to be part of the MOU, but that, you know, has this like, okay, here's how we're agreeing to do the cost sharing and the infrastructure cost sharing. So the cost sharing on Wednesday is for cost sharing, is for the cost sharing agreement, which is a subset of the MOU.
Okay.
All right. The one-stop operator is a procurement process that we talk about the one-stop operator in the MOU. We say there's going to be one, but we haven't. We just said we're in procurement mode on it right now. It's also a requirement for our system. It's like the MOU's requirement, the one-stop operator's requirement. So the one-stop operator is not about cost sharing. There's a connection that could be related to cost sharing, as I was just saying to Sherry, because you know the partners have to agree what they're going to come together and share costs on. And if the partner says, I don't want to pay for a one-stop operator, then that's a cost-sharing conversation that affects what you're doing with the one-stop operators. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and it could overlap what you're doing, an activity.
There's definitely connections. Yes. Those, that's where there's interrelationship between these things. There's dynamics and kind of these things interconnect with each other. But the one-stop operator is it's confusing because it's even going to be more confusing because I think at one point in time, we're going to have a one-stop operator bidders conference number two. And I think later that morning at 11 o'clock, we're going to have the cost sharing conversation with the required partners invited, those who can attend. Can't come. You guys, RCC and Donna Llewellyn couldn't come to Friday's meeting. So we scheduled a Wednesday meeting with you all at 8:30 to 10.
I'll be there for that, and I'm hoping that the rest of my college team has figured out the differences between all of this, but they might need a little clarification as well.
No problem. That's why we scheduled it for an hour and a half, even though Donna can only join us for 9 o'clock.
Okay. And then my other question is for Sherry and Tabitha. I can't remember if we're planning on meeting next week to discuss what we heard today or...
You know, we didn't schedule anything, but we should.
And I think we have an...
I'm going to go ahead and end. I think I think we're done with the bidders conference. I'm going to go ahead and end the recording and let you guys talk then, because that's just
great. That would be great. Yeah.
Okay.